Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the New Books in Performing Arts podcast, a podcast from the New Books Network. My name is Andy Boyd, and today I'm talking with Brian Kulik about his book, The Secret Life of Theater, on the Nature and Function of Theatrical Representation. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here with you.
I'd love to know a little bit about kind of how you first got involved with the theater. Were you like a kid who went to theater camp and that kind of thing, or did it come later on?
You know, I wish it did, but when I was interested in film when I was young, and when I went to UCLA as an undergraduate, and the easiest way to get into the film program was to start in the theater program and then just transfer over. So that's what I did. But I fell in love with theater, so I just decided to stay and never transferred over. So that's basically how it happened. I had a great group of teachers and extraordinary classmates, and it just seemed like a world that you would never want to leave. So I didn't.
Yeah, I definitely found when I was in, you teach at Columbia where I went to grad school, and I definitely found that the theater kids were, as a whole, a lot more interesting, at least to me, than the film kids that I interacted with were. So I don't know if you had the same experience.
Well, I was, you know, ironically, many of my friends who were in the theater program went on to quite, you know, amazing careers in film and television. So, and I may be the only theater guy, or a handful of us stayed in theater, but friends of mine, you know, did Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Lethal Weapon. My classmate was Tim Robbins. So it was an interesting, you could always bop over to the film program and do something and then bop back if you wanted.
That's a pretty good list. What inspired you to write this book, The Secret Life of Theater?
You know, a couple things. I think the big thing was that when you start doing theater outside of school, you sort of move away from the why of theater, and you're really dealing a lot with the how. You know, how do I make this work? You know, how do I get this actor to do this? How do I get the producer to give me more money? How do I get an audience to pay attention? And when you sit down and talk to other colleagues, you talk about how. How are we going to make this happen? How, and it was how all the way down. And so when I was really involved with the how of things. I ran a theater called Classic Stage Company for a period of time, and that was how, in all capital letters with an exclamation point at the end of it, and like 10 question marks afterwards. And so after doing that for like 14 years, I just thought, you know, I would like to take some time off and get back to the why of theater, you know, and reconnect with what this thing is that I've devoted an enormous chunk of my life to. And that sort of happened simultaneous to rereading a wonderful short story by the South American author Argentinian author Borges, a little story called Averroes's Search. Averroes was the translator of the Poetics
Into Arabic, right?
Into Arabic, yes. Thank you. And you know, they didn't have a theater tradition. They had a great poetry tradition at that point in time, but no theater. Theater wouldn't be for several hundred years after Averroes. So when he got to the terms, and this is true, this isn't made up by Borges, when he got to the terms comedy and tragedy, he had no conception of what that meant. And the short story tries to give this, it takes place the day that Averroes has to translate these two words. And the story gives him, over the course of one day, three huge hints at what they might mean. And those three hints were like rabbit holes of that you could sort of plunge down as a theater person. And they really got to these big why questions of, you know, of theater. And so the combination of exhaustion and then being reconnecting with this Borges short story sort of was the magic alchemy that led to the led to me wanting to sit down and try to write something.
And I hope this question doesn't seem like too much of like a reading comprehension quiz, but what are the three examples that he encounters that are kind of hints for what, you know, what comedy and tragedy might have been?
Oh, they're great. They're wonderful. The first is that Averroes looks out his window and he sees children playing. And the children are interestingly enough, they're reenacting the morning prayer. So one child is performing the turret, one child is performing the role of the worshiper, and one child is performing the role of the person who's reciting the morning prayer. And
The turret had to have been the little brother, I gotta think.
Yeah, right. No one wants to be the turret, for goodness sake. Right. And so that was the first. That's the first clue. And the second clue, which is my favorite of the clues, is he goes to a party where someone has just returned from China, and the traveler is talking about this amazing building that he was in, this lacquered house, where basically, as he describes it, you realize this is a theater. He was in a theater. He was watching a play. Although, again, the language and the words, they have no language or words for this phenomenon. And one of the guests is very confused, and he says, wait a minute, are you trying to tell me, I'm paraphrasing, of course, are you trying to tell me that it takes the Chinese people 40 individuals to tell a story, because he talks about musicians and people who perform things, and the traveler says, yes, it took 40 people to tell that story, and the host of the party says, well, we are far superior because it only takes one person to tell our stories. And I thought that really was what started me thinking, which is, you know, why do we need, if we can tell a story, if we can sit around a campfire and tell a story, why do we need 40 people? Why do we need it? What do we gain when we move from telling something to showing something? What happens in that process? And then the last clue in the short story has to do with the recounting of a very famous story about four religious seekers who go to sleep in a cave and wake up 100 years later and don't realize it eventually. And that obviously has echoes to Plato's cave, although the way Borges sort of turns the whole thing on its head. And those are his big three clues.
It's so funny. I feel like that idea that what we do in theater is we tell stories has become axiomatic and maybe even cliched, but it's actually at a fundamental level kind of just literally wrong. Like, we literally do not. I mean, you know, some faith healer by Brian Friel, you know, tells a story, but most plays are up to something else, right?
Well, I think obviously, there are many, I think, languages that happen when you're watching a theater piece or experiencing, let's say experiencing theater piece. And there certainly is language, you know, is dialogue, is, and there's, and out of that and the conflicts of that comes a story, but there's a whole lot of other stuff, other languages, the language of the body, language of tone, language of movement, that tell other kinds of stories, and have different registers of meaning.
One of the other things that just occurred to me hearing you kind of recount that Borges story is just how bizarre it is that theater is an art form that has died out as many times as it has, you know, that even in the Western tradition, even Western Europe, you know, there are periods of hundreds of years at a time where there aren't really plays, which is so bizarre because it always strikes me as the sort of the most intuitive art form. I mean, you know, little kids do a form of theater all the time. So it's always struck me as kind of totally weird that, that it does die out for many, many different periods in world history.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but what's great about it is it's really cheap to do, to make when you consider the other media, you know, it's very easy to just, you know, get a, you know, as what is it, Judy Garland and Mickey Rooney, get a barn and put on a show. I think that's also one of the beauties of theater, which is that you constantly have to recreate it. So Greek theater dies out, and then the Italian Renaissance wants to recreate it, and they end up making opera instead. So there's something beautiful about, you know, we don't know. People say they know how Shakespeare was done, and we have the Globe Theater now, and we know some things about how Shakespeare is done, but we don't really, you know what the scale of acting was, what the size of it was, you know, how hammy, you know, or how real it was. Mm-hmm. We don't know how it was really spoken. There are no rules handed down. We've intuited rules. And so we have to make them up all over again. And there's something beautiful about that part of the equation of this collaboration over time between what was and what we are now. And in some ways, to me, that's one of the most exciting things about theater. There are other cultures who figured this out much faster and tried to, you know, really take care of tradition. So when you look at the extraordinary theater, you know, no theater or kabuki theater, you're talking about a tradition that's unbroken. You know, the link is unbroken for quite a long period of time. But as a result of that, some of that theater really has been tied to a kind of tradition that it can't quite escape from. Whereas in the West, because of our short attention spans and things like that, we constantly
periodic attacks by Puritans, et cetera. Yes,
little things like that, little plagues, little things like that. And then as a result of that, you know, we get to constantly reinvent Shakespeare or reinvent the Greeks or reinvent Chekhov. And I think that's also part of the fun of it, if that makes any sense.
And Shakespeare seemed to have a really keen sense of the kind of pathos of that situation, of kind of constantly creating something that is temporary and will be gone by the end of the, you know, by midnight. I feel like that's all over his play. I mean, I'm thinking of the last speech in The Tempest, but you could find it, you know, in constant plays of his.
Completely, completely. And that's one of the beautiful things I think about The Tempest, and also ironically in the Borges short story, which is the failure of art, the fact that how hard it is to sustain an illusion. That's the thing that breaks Prospero's heart is, you know, he puts on a mask, which Shakespeare was never a big fan of, but he puts on a mask for his son-in-law and daughter, and it collapses, you know, and that's where he gives a great speech about, you know, we are nothing more than, you know, than dreams. Again, I'm paraphrasing, but and this idea that theater, you know, constantly collapses, fails, is actually part of what's spectacular about it. You know, when you watch a film is an interesting phenomenon, something in relationship to sound and light and what light does in a dark room. And, you know, and you can fall down the rabbit hole of a film and never pull yourself out until the film is over. That doesn't necessarily happen in theater. In theater, your consciousness is constantly being thrown backwards and forwards. It's in the event, and then the idiot in front of you moves their head or coughs, and then suddenly you're not in Julius Caesar, but you're in a over-refrigerated a theater, way too far in the back, and it takes you a while to reorient yourself. But that respiratory, it's almost like a in and out, like tides being drawn into the theater and then being thrown out of it, creates a very interesting kind of consciousness that I think is also a very important byproduct of what theater does and why theater is, although traffics in many of the same aspects as film storytelling, is a radically different, phenomenologically different experience as a viewer. Mm-hmm.
And that experience of kind of following a story but not being totally sucked in is really central to what Brecht is up to, in the 20th century. And you kind of draw a connection between Brecht's kind of awareness of the sort of shoddiness of theatrical representation and Shakespeare's, which you've already touched on a little bit. What do you see as being the kind of similarities between how Brecht and Shakespeare view theater and what are the differences? I mean, they're obviously, Shakespeare's not a Marxist, but I imagine that there are more differences.
You might think that he was a Marxist for a moment.
Right.
It was Marx's favorite play, but gosh, that's a wonderful and huge question. I mean, I think one of the things Brecht did with a lot of help from the Russians was really kind of for the first time, although Shakespeare was doing it, that he articulated what the Renaissance and what the Greek theater was doing, which is that you're in the story and then you're out of the story. He calls this the alienation effect. You're in it and then you're thrown out. And he really loves this idea of being thrown out, because in the moment you're thrown out, you become critical of what you've just seen. And most of our days, we're in something, we're in work, we're in a game, we're in our television show, we're in. And something has to happen. We're in our cars, we're driving, and then we get into a wreck and we're thrown out of our driving state, if this makes any sense. Mm-hmm. So Brecht was really fascinated with these road bumps, with that sort of slowed you down or made you stop and made you think. And in that process, what starts to happen is you start to realize how in a play is a construction, and literally it's flats and scenery, but reality, New York City is a construction. It isn't. This is the distinction that Heidegger makes between the earth and the world. The world is a construction. The earth is the earth. The world sits on top of the earth and makes us forget about the earth and fools us into thinking it's a priori. So, i.e., there's always been kings. There's always been taxation. There's always been these things. And we're just in that world. But if we get thrown out for a moment and look at it differently, we start to see the seams, in the flats on theater, we start to see the seams of our own reality, which doesn't have to be the way we were taught in elementary school. That's maybe the way they would like the world to work, but that's not necessarily the only way or an a priori or a natural way. And if something can be deconstructed, that means it can be reconstructed. And so I think when you ask what's the difference between Shakespeare and Brecht, they're both wildly aware of the fragility of our reality, how easily it can, and Shakespeare's very nervous about that. He's very nervous about the idea of our world collapsing. Brecht is like, bring it, man, just do it. Because we'll build something better. We'll build something even better out of that.
Yeah.
And so both are aware of the fragility and of our mutually agreed reality. One wants to preserve it, protect it, enhance it, make it better, and remind us how precious and fragile it actually is, how easily and how quickly it can be broken. That's Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And Brecht says, where's the hammer? Give it to me right now. Let's get to work, guys.
Yeah. I heard a story. This is like slightly off topic, but I heard a story a while ago in an interview with somebody who was Saul Bellow's assistant towards the end of his life. And it was like a beautiful spring day in Chicago, and he was driving Saul Bellow around, and they kind of passed the, you know, the kind of quad at UChicago. And Bellow had him pull over, and he rolled down his window, and he just yelled, "Death, death, death." And the assistant said, "You know, why did you just do that?" And he goes, "I just thought someone should remind them."
Yeah, no, that's great.
That's part of what Shakespeare's up to, I think. It's just kind of, you know, at any moment, like there's, I mean, obviously there's so much death in the plays themselves, but also just like this life thing that you think is so solid is actually, you know, completely topsy-turvy and, you know, can change on a dime at any moment.
Totally. You know, one of the things, one of Brecht's famous quotes is, sometimes you have to say no so loudly that the audience stands up and screams, "Yes, goddammit," you know, and so I think, you know, the negativity or negation in the theater is actually a tremendously powerful tool for change, for progress.
Part of what you do in the book is you kind of take us on a very quick tour of theater history, and you kind of look at some key moments in kind of classic plays in the Western canon, but you focus less on dialogue than you do on kind of stage directions and specific physical moments in these plays. Why did you want to draw our attention to those moments?
Well, you know, I'm a director by trade, so of course I'm going to be slightly, sometimes as interested in the stage directions as I am in the dialogue. I always feel like stage directions get short shrift, you know, when I was working on that essay, I thought, could you tell the history of theater in, I don't know, what it was, like nine stage directions. Could you find nine stage directions that told you everything you needed to know about what theater can do? And so I started, you know, some of those moments I've had the great opportunity to stage, some of them I've had the great opportunity to teach, and some of them I just always wanted to tackle or wanted to try my hand at or my mind at understanding. And so what happens? I mean, it goes back to something that we were talking about earlier, which is that theater is made up of many languages. There are languages that we are aware of, but we don't really call them languages. There's the language of proximity, which is how close we allow ourselves to be in relationship with one another, which is based on how much we trust one another. And people have built into them a natural sense of proximity. You know, it's like, I'm not supposed to get any closer than this unless I want to get punched or kissed, you know. Mm-hmm. And we all go 5.5 feet. We just do that. We just go 5.5 feet, you know, and especially in the age of COVID, we're even more aware of proximity. So that suddenly when you're dealing with something like Romeo and Juliet, where Romeo's down on the ground and Juliet's up above, you're dealing with the language of proximity, and you're dealing with a very interesting aspect of proximity, which is verticality. What does it mean to be down below? What does it mean to be up above? Why do we image the object of our adoration, whether it's a woman or a guy? Why are they up in a balcony, and why is God up in the heavens? Why do we keep, you know, putting love, it's not only out of our reach, but above our reach. Mm-hmm. What does that mean? It means something to us. It conjures something to us. And so when we see that sort of trope where you see lovers and they're running and there is a great distance between them and then and the music soaring and they finally embrace and kiss, that is a proximal sentence, which says something to us without dialogue, without words, if that makes sense, and mm-hmm. impacts on us in the same way as a piece of dialogue would. So the impulse to talk about stage directions was to say there are all these other languages, language of time, language of space, proximity, silence, all of these little things that we are also We speak many more languages than we actually think we do, mm-hmm. or intuit many more languages than we think we do.
And that kind of spatial language feels like one of the kind of essential tools of theater that almost no other art form uses in the same way. I mean, maybe dance or something like that, but that's really pretty central to what makes theater theater, probably.
It definitely, I mean, the fact that space is dead until you move. Do you know what I'm saying? In other words, mm-hmm. space is flat until the human body starts moving. And then suddenly it comes to life in all sorts of ways. And it's much, time and space. One of the things that theater teaches us is that they are incredibly relative, as Einstein says, that Happy Days and Macbeth are the same amount of clock time. If you do Macbeth right and you do Happy Days right, they should clock in at about 90 minutes each. That's clock time, but experiential time, felt time. Oh my goodness. Macbeth is a roller coaster ride and Happy Days is this sort of infinite, endless experience. So suddenly it's no longer time, but duration that changes. And so you can have that feeling in a film as well. There's no reason why you can't, but the concrete palpable, the moment when the three sisters pose for a photograph, and we've all had this experience where it takes the photographer way too long to snap the picture. And in that moment, time becomes manifest. We feel time as a palpable concrete thing. It comes out of the shadows where it's been hiding and you suddenly get a glimpse of it and you go, oh my God, there's this phenomenon called time and it's present. We just keep, we're so in it, we keep forgetting about it. Mm-hmm. And so theater helps you reconnect with those moments, if that makes sense. It reconnects you to these things that, in the rush of life, we tend to forget. The habits that we form dull us from the kind of extraordinary wonder of what it means to actually be alive. And so part of these different languages that theater speaks, part of what they're trying to do is wake you up, remind mm-hmm. you for a moment about these wondrous aspects of existence.
And you point out that part of how theater does that is by just being, so much more stripped down, even in a very lush, lavishly detailed production of like a Doll's House or something. It's still going to be much less cluttered than an actual living room. Theater is always sort of a pared down representation of reality. And that process of selecting details and kind of highlighting them is part of what charges them with meaning, right?
Oh yeah, everything means more because there's less on the stage. Oftentimes, when I was going to school, when I was back at UCLA, and I was contemplating the difference between going to film and theater, the critic David Denby wrote a very famous article for the New York Magazine called "Why I Hate Theater," and I read it and I went, "Oh my God, this is exactly." I should write an article saying why I love theater, and I would use all of David Denby's examples because what he hated was exactly what I love. Like, for instance, mm-hmm. he said, he can't stand Willie Loman and Death of a Salesman because he's got those two suitcases. He's carrying those two suitcases, and you never get to see what's inside the suitcases. You never get to know what Willie Loman is selling because what he's selling are two metaphors. If you opened up the suitcase, it would just be a metaphor. It's a metaphor for – and it's just too much. It's just too much for David Denby. He doesn't mm-hmm. like when a door is more than a door or a suitcase is more than a suitcase. And the extraordinary thing about film is – film domesticates everything in the same way that we domesticate many of the things out of habit. So doors, suitcases, books, windows, they just become things, right? But in the theater, if you only have a door, oh my goodness, suddenly that door is very important. It starts to mean more. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the beauties about when you're dealing with certain writers like Brecht, like Molière, like Shakespeare, they choose these elements, and that's the only thing. And that letter suddenly becomes a character in of itself. Or If you see what I'm trying to get at with this.
The handkerchief in Othello or, yeah.
Yes. Oh my God. That's a great example where suddenly these things just mean more. The red carpet that Agamemnon walks on isn't a carpet when it's rolled out. It's suddenly, is it the blood of all the men that was spilt, you know, from the time that he was at Troy? Is it a premonition of the blood that of his own body that's about to be spilt moments from now when his wife stabs him or actually hacks him apart with an axe? So things in the theater, because of the stripped down nature, have the opportunity to stand out, be ecstatic in a way, in the oldest form of that word. They stand outside. And you're able to suddenly, they start to just simply mean more than what they do in our day-to-day life.
That sense of a symbol having multiple meanings seems to be something that was just kind of occurred very naturally to a lot of ancient civilizations. You know, you point out ancient Greece, but I think you could probably say the same thing about ancient Egyptian art. And if we had more traces of their theater, maybe that would be true of their theater. That feeling of, you know, it's not just a metaphor where one thing is standing in for something else, but it's this sort of rich combination of kind of bundled meanings, right?
Oh yeah, totally. You know, I always feel like a metaphor is like a magician's hat trick. Uh-huh. It's a hat. No, it's a dove. You know, it's always about changing one thing into another thing. And there's a lot of fun with metaphor. And the time signature of metaphor is very quick. It's this, and now it's that. But a symbol sort of just sits there as a big question mark. And it says, just try. Just try to unpack me.
Yeah.
And some symbols are so rich that they are bottomless. You can't get to the bottom of them. Freud called these kinds of symbols overdetermined. That you could take this symbol to all these different psychoanalysts, and they would give you a different interpretation of it. It's just too rich, mm-hmm. as a result of it. So yeah, the symbol is an amazingly powerful thing, and then like a syndosh, it can stand in. A symbol can be so strong that it can create an entire world. You can just have a sink, you know, or a stove, and suddenly your mind will make the kitchen. Right? That's another thing that film. That's one of the fundamental differences between how film is usually done and how theater works is we don't need necessarily to have the entire kitchen and it's actually maybe slightly more interesting if there's one symbol, one element that creates the entire world and we collaborate in that creation. Mm-hmm. That's where I think you start to get to the real magic of theater. Theater is an interesting thing. It keys into something that we just do as human beings that is so profound. You know, when you know Vygotsky, the Russian great Russian neurologist says this. You know, children when they're learning language, you know, a stick is a stick is a stick is a stick. It takes a long time for a kid to learn that this stick has a name, and that name is stick. And every time, and that's what it is, and that's the way it's going to be. But then at a certain age, they go, this stick can be a horse. And then suddenly, oh my God, you know, now you're in the realm of metaphor. Now you're in the realm of invention, you know, where we can take one thing and turn it into something else. And so when you deal with certain kinds of theater, whether it's Chinese theater or whether it's theater complicité, one of the things that happens is because that kind of theater is metaphoric. The stick is a horse. It returns you to that amazing moment when you're 6 years old or 5 years old, or I don't know how old you are when you make that epistemological leap, but it's an amazing moment. And you can still get an adrenaline rush, even I do as an Altacocker, as a 60-year-old, you know, when I'm asked to see an overturned on Wah and imagine that that's a boat in the ocean. Mm-hmm. And I just get as happy as can be. I just get giddy over being asked to participate in making that meaning.
I remember I saw a show once where there was a line. I wish I remembered who put this show up, but there's a line where somebody held up, a pointer finger and a thumb and said, "This whole show, we've been pretending this is a gun." And then they extended their middle finger as well. And they said, "This is a gun." This is totally thrilling moment of letting us in on the joke of, yes, we're pretending that something isn't what it is, but then also being like, okay, now will you accept, now that now that we've all set out in the open that we're just pretending, will you still go along with this story? And the audience was completely there for it. It was a magical moment.
We do that, if you see, if you do an experiment, let's say we did this at CSC once where we were doing Romeo and Juliet, and this has been done before, we didn't come up with this, but where we asked two extraordinary actors, Judith Roberts and Austin Pendleton, to play Romeo and Juliet. And I think they might both are probably in their 70s. And so there's a moment, obviously, when that starts, when they start reading, where you go, okay, they're in their 70s and they're playing Romeo and Juliet. And about 4 minutes in, that disappears and you're just watching Austin fall in love with Judith. And that's, my God, that's how adaptable the human imagination is. And it's that adaptability that will hopefully save us, our ability to see more, read more, into things than what is presented to us, make more out of what we're seeing, transform it. The alchemy of our imaginations. If anything's going to save us, it's going to be that.
Mm-hmm. Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
This is a slight detour just into kind of like some theater history that hadn't occurred to me until I read your book. But you mentioned Shakespeare's influence from Italian Renaissance theater, which had never occurred to me. But then once you pointed it out, I was like, oh, right. Like, so many of those plays take place in Italy and in this sort of like fantastic, unrealistic Venice has no canals, version of Italy. And it's like, oh, right. He liked Italian plays. And so when he wrote plays in imitation of them, he set them in Italy and used Italian names. So what was the kind of the nature of that influence? Like, what did he take from that tradition?
Well, I think if I can prior to that question, you bring up another question that's also very interesting. So let me see if I can do both in one, which is Shakespeare loves, the globe, right? And calls his theater the globe. And one of the things Elizabethans were particularly kooky about was they had an opinion about every country. You would say a country, Romania, I don't know if it was called Romania, Macedonia, they would have an opinion about it, right? So in the land of symbols, places became symbols, Vienna, Venice, Verona. To an Elizabethan, each of those worlds suggested a unique metaphorical world, if that makes sense. So an Elizabethan knows the difference between Venice and Verona, even though they've never been there. But they've read enough short stories and they've heard enough from people who have been there to know that Venice is a land of illusion and deceit and hide and seek. And Verona is just too darn hot. It's just too hot. And that something about that sun and the heat and the angle of the light makes people kill each other. So the idea of the place starts to do so much work. Instead of like hiring Santo Loquasto to do a set, you just go Verona. And instead of trying to hire John Lee Beatty to do a set, you say, Bohemia. And the Elizabethan mind does the rest of the work for you, if that makes sense. But in terms of, the interesting thing about, the Italian explosion of theater that happens in the Renaissance is just unprecedented. And of course, much of this is imp- improvisational. So we don't even have the scripts. You know, Tempest is a play that is most likely stolen from a Commedia scenario. And you know, acting companies would have their scenarios, their stories, and they were like Bibles. You just didn't give them away. You held on to them because that was your livelihood. Every so often, a leaf of one of these, you know, Bibles would, you know, blow away and cross the channel and end up in England, and Shakespeare would grab it and go, I can run with this. But the Italian influence, storytelling wise, is huge. And clearly there's something temperamental. You know, I think you're right. When you look at the places he sets things, you know, Pride of Place might go to the Italians. He certainly, you know, is enamored with many, you know, major stories, Romeo and Juliet, Othello, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think As You Like It, I think is also originally comes from an Italian source.
Yeah. Hmm. And what do you feel like, what kind of, like, I don't know, techniques did he learn from that tradition, do you think? Like what kind of, I mean, was it plotting? Was it character? What things did he learn from Commedia?
Well, you know, I think the thing about Shakespeare is that he's, you know, the Renaissance had a notion that he was very good at, which is a concept called lively turning. And what this meant was you take the source material, but you turn it, you know, and so it's not about being original, coming up with your own story. It's about taking a story and flipping it in a way so that, for instance, in Winter's Tale, the source material by Greene, you know, the Leontes figure actually does go to sleep with his daughter. You know, so that's the tragedy of it. And Shakespeare takes that same story, flips it, and of course, Leontes recognizes his daughter, and then he's reunited with his wife, who's a statue, and comes to life. That's where Shakespeare's invention comes in. So I think what Shakespeare is constantly looking for is great raw material to turn. Mm-hmm. And so what you get with the Italian repertory is, you know, tremendous iconic moments. A guy on the street, a girl in a balcony. I can run with that, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There are these sort of, you know, the idea of the pastoral, being in the forest, being, you know, this is, you know, Italian literature 101 of the Renaissance. Arcadia is not only an Elizabethan trope, but it also has the pastoral, you know, has its genealogy in the Italians. So I think it's that this is all the ingredients that he needs to get things going. And he finds some of the best ingredients for his theatrical sauces or meals through these kind of spices from the Italian mm-hmm. repertoire.
I wonder if part of the reason, I mean, it seems like you're talking about a lot of sort of visual moments. I wonder if part of the reason is because, like, those are the things that, you know, if you're performing a script where the dialogue is improvised, the stuff you write down is, we have to get to this certain set piece at the end of the first act. You know, I wonder if it's sort of an inherently, you know, visual way of thinking if you're kind of working in that Commedia style.
Well, even, you know, but one of the things, because of the nature of how plays were rehearsed during that period of time, no one had a full script. Everybody had just their role, literally a role, which mm-hmm. had every line and their cue line on it. So no one had in their head the whole script. So they had to go, just before they walked on stage, they needed to look at a couple pieces of paper that were posted that told you the order of the scenes in case you got confused. So you didn't walk out when Hamlet is telling Ophelia to get thee to a nunnery. You don't, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern don't just suddenly walk in and want to, you know, invite him to see a play. So there is this kind of, and a lot of plays in Elizabethan times don't exist anymore, obviously. But we do have these pages. We can sort of reconstruct a very famous play at the time called Troy, based on the description of, you know, so-and-so at the tower, blah, 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 and this sort of thing. So there's something about the skeleton of a Commedia scenario and the skeleton of an Elizabethan show where you just have these big set pieces and you learn the order and then you do them.
Mm-hmm. One of the kind of tropes of a certain type of contemporary discussion about theater is that everybody wants to kind of pile on Aristotle and talk about all the things that he misses or kind of oversimplifies or something like that, which I understand. I mean, I certainly think he's had his place in the culture long enough, but at the same time, The Poetics is just an extraordinarily insightful book. And as, you know, as possibly the first work of literary criticism in the Western tradition, it's kind of amazing how many of the things still seem interesting to us today. You make a connection I hadn't really thought about much before between how Aristotle writes about emotion in other works of his and how he writes about theater. Could you kind of talk a bit about the connection between those two parts of his theory?
Well, I think I can. I mean, that this was a particularly dense part of the book, and I wrote the book 5 years ago.
Let me kind of lower the stakes for you by just saying you're about the fifth person I've asked what is catharsis on this show, and no one's been able to really explain it to me to my satisfaction yet. So, you know, I'm happy to add another perspective without it being a definitive one.
Cool. So basically, first of all, you know, Aristotle, you know, his predecessor and teacher, Plato, as we all know, was not a big fan of the arts, and nor was he a big fan of emotion, and really spent a tremendous amount of energy in these Socratic dialogues dinging not only art, but also the importance of emotion. And emotion needs to be reined in. It needs to be controlled by logos. You know, all of these things. And so part of Aristotle's job, I think he felt, was to like speak up for emotion and to basically make a very strong argument, which now has been borne out in neurobiology, that we don't make decisions based on logic. I mean, logic is a part of it, but the tipping point is how we feel about it. And so what Aristotle ultimately is saying is, let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. This, how you feel about something is part of the process of coming to a conclusion. And it is a very important part of it. And you can't disentangle thought and feeling. They're intertwined in a way that is just impossible. If you try to sever them, it dies on the vine, so to speak. So as a result of that, you know, Aristotle begins to start thinking about, you know, how theater works emotionally. And, you know, he comes to the conclusion that a lot of Greek theater, you know, the famous line that he says is that, it engenders, it engenders pity and fear, and that leads to catharsis. Mm-hmm. Now, it's interesting that those integers, pity, fear, catharsis. Why not fear, pity, catharsis? Why is it so important that pity is first and fear follows? And then how does those two things lead to this idea of catharsis, which is a medical term? Well, it's a term that basically means taking a crap. It's about dark matter that is sort of then brought to light. It's about lustration. It's about, and then ultimately about purgation.
And if you think about sort of the theory of the humors, right? It's that idea of you have an excess of black bile or something, and you need to get that sort of expelled, and then you'll be better. Is that sort of the ballpark that we're talking about?
Yeah, totally. We're talking about the idea that how do you expel all this dark matter that's in you? You know, and catharsis, a purgative, is a great way of doing it. And of course, this is a intellectual form of purgation in this respect. But it seems to me that one of the things that starts to happen is that the idea that you see something and engenders pity, and we should not think that pity means sympathy. Sympathy is a word that's not even invented yet. The only time we have an example of sympathy in Greek is is Plato, someone yawns and then Socrates wants to yawn, and that is called a sympathetic response. So the idea of sympathy doesn't grow beyond the yawn until you get to the Renaissance. So what you have is pity, and pity, as it sounds, is like, I take pity on this lowly person. You know, I'm better than this person. This poor person is less than me, and I pity them because they're less than me. And so when, for instance, when Priam goes to the tent of Achilles and wants to see his son Hector, that his dead son Hector's body, if we came into the tent, we would probably do something like this. We would say, Achilles, you lost your lover, I lost my son. There's something between, you know, we share this mutual loss. This is, we can sympathize with one another because we have this common denominator of losing someone young that we love. That would maybe be the way that we would argue, please now give me a chance to look at my son. That's not how the Greeks thought about things. Priam, a king, comes into the tent and says, look at me. I'm a pathetic old man. And the person who was going to defend me, you know, is dead. I have no one to defend me. You, your father, that lucky son of a bitch, still has you, but I have nothing. Let me see my son. In other words, he's saying, pity me. Mm-hmm. Take pity on me.
He's lowering himself.
Exactly. And that is the way the Greeks, that's the way they can imagine beyond familial ties. The only way they can sort of relate to the outsider or someone who's beyond the familial bonds or beyond the tribal bonds is in the form of pity. So when a Greek audience member is watching tragedy, they are not sympathizing or empathizing, which is another word which sounds as old as sympathy, but empathy is a 20th century conception. It's a word that's invented in the 20th century for expressionist art. So the Greek would pity, a Renaissance person would be sympathetic, you know, blah, 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 blah. But so I'm watching Oedipus and I pity him. I feel superior to him. I feel bad for him, but I'm not him. I'm above him. But the next thing I might feel is, holy moly, I could become him. Fear. The fear suddenly comes into this. And that fear that I could be that person is huge. And this is the problem, is how do I, now that that fear is in me, it's a virus. It's attacking my whole sense of self and self-reliance. How do I get rid of this fear that's suddenly in me? I was impenetrable. I was fine until I came to this stupid play. Mm-hmm. And then I have to feel pity. And now I'm fearful that I'm going to be that jerk and poke my eyes out. Damn it. How do I get rid of this? How do I get rid of this? And this is the interesting thing. We're told, you know, well, you cathart it out. Well, how do you cathart it? Where does the catharsis happen? When does it happen? This is a big problem. You know, Walter Benjamin asked this question, is when does catharsis actually happen? You know, he started to think that it happened in the Seder play. It didn't happen in the play proper. You laughed it out of you. But when you start to go down this path, you realize that catharsis what fills you in this moment that needs to be catharted is a strong emotion. And it doesn't have to be fear. It could be wonder. You know, awe. You know, sometimes we see something and we're just in awe of it, and it fills us, and we don't have language for it. Terror, you know, this is what Heidegger says, you know, is that we have like 12 basic attunements, moods that we get into. Anxiety is his favorite. Boredom is another. Wonder is the most wondrous of these. And they all, it's very hard to bring those moods into language. Mm-hmm. They can be felt profoundly and disturbingly, but in order to deal with them, you feel compelled to put it into language. So I sort of take a Heideggerian view, or it's sort of by way of Freud, which is that the catharsis is you see something that disturbs you and you don't know how to articulate it, and you go home and you talk to your lover or your best friend and you talk it out. And in the talking out what was disturbing to you, you suddenly are purged of this. You suddenly, it's a talking cure in a way.
Mm-hmm. And Aaron so said, it's the discussion after drinks that matters more than
that's this. That's the golden moment. It doesn't happen in the play. It happens afterwards. And, you know, Hannah Arendt has this wonderful observation where she says that, you know, if you talk about heroism, bravery, it'll start to make you brave. If you talk about hope, it can start to make you hopeful. You know, it won't last, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't last. But for a moment, you're talking about courage and you suddenly feel courageous. And so to me, Greek theater is exactly that. For a couple moments, you're completely disturbed. You don't know what to make of it all. You articulate it. You're purged of it. You're conscious of it. You've named it. You own it. And then you forget about it. And then you have to go back to the theater again to see it over and over again until you learn your lesson.
Now, part of Aristotle's, like another part of Aristotle's sort of system of thought is when he, in the Nicomachean Ethics, he talks about the sort of golden mean being the ethical ideal between these two extremes, you know, of, you know, excessively cowardly versus being excessively risk-taking. You know, the golden mean between those is a proper amount of courage. Is that related to this idea that maybe part of what it's doing is you go to the theater, you feel these extreme emotions, and then you kind of get it out of your system and you can be sort of more even keeled in your daily life as a kind of responsible citizen of the Athenian polity?
That, I mean, anger management was a huge issue, you know, clearly for the Greeks, you know, clearly, I mean, literally the Iliad, you know, starts with the line, you know, I sing of wrath, you know, this is the big problem is wrath. Right. And at the very end of the Iliad, the last image is of a horse bridle, you know, the idea of bridling one's passion. So you could say that, you know, one could be very reductive, you know, and sort of say that all Greek theater is anger management work, you know. I don't believe that, but I had a friend who used to say, I can name, you know, there used to be this thing, you're too young for it, but there used to be a show called Name That Tune. And the whole thing was, how many notes did it you need before you could name that tune? You know, yeah. I can do it in three notes. I can do it in one note. You know? And so my friend, you know, could like get all these genres of theater or authors, you know, down to like two notes, you know, so like Chekhov would be live now, you know, that would be the message, the takeaway. Shakespeare would be see better, right? And then Greek theater would be careful, or maybe be very, very careful, you know, if you really want to do it. And so there is an aspect of, you know, and this is where Sanskrit theater becomes interesting, because it's not as interested in the modality, in the attunement of anxiety or terror or fear, phobos, as the Greeks are. They're interested in another Heideggerian attunement, which is wonder. You know, the miracle of existence, the miracle of being. And so, you know, they want to put the audience in contact with that. You see that in Shakespeare too, you know, that there's something very, if you read Shakuntala, and then compare it. It feels, you know, your first comparison would be, oh, maybe Shakespeare's Winter's Tale, you know, where what the late works of Shakespeare try to engender, they move away from tragedy and they try to engender another state that's very hard to articulate or bring into words, which is the wonder of existence. But both the Greek theater and parts aspects of Sanskrit theater, which is a much more complicated and much more extensive, I mean, longer history of development. They're both interested in experiences that are hard to put into language. You see something, it moves you to the moment of the need to articulate it. and that, and then that it takes you to the doorstep of articulation and says, finish it. And then you have to name what you felt. And the Greeks are very interested in naming death. And Sanskrit drama is very interested in naming life, the miracle of life.
Well, Brian, I think that's a great note to end on. There's so much more to get to in this book, but I want to leave something for the reader to discover on their own. Thanks so much for being on New Books in Performing Arts to talk about The Secret Life of Theater. This was really fun.
I really enjoyed getting a chance to spend some time with you and talk theater.
And could you, you mentioned it a little bit before we started recording, but could you tell us a little bit about the book that you have coming out next year?
I have a book coming out in January called Staging the End of the World, Theater in the Time of Climate Change. And it's basically looks at, theater has been interested in the end of the world since the world began. So Sanskrit theater, Greek theater, right away, it's interested in the end of the world. And so this book just tries to walk you through, the big epochs, and sort of show you all the ways the world has ended. Not to say that, and I'm making a very big distinction by saying world, not earth.
Mm-hmm.
An empire, might fall. A world might fall, but the earth remains, thankfully. We are now at a point where actually we're destroying not only our world, but also the earth as well. So we're poised at a point where the destruction of a world, it will be the destruction of our planet, which means the destruction of all life. It sounds like a big Debbie Downer book, but actually the thing that's kind of beautiful about once you spend time with these plays is you realize that they're not about the end of the world. They're about the continuance of the world. Is mm-hmm. What values, what things are necessary to save the things you love. And every epoch has a very beautiful insight into ways of preserving what is best in humanity. And that ultimately is what the book is about.
Well, that sounds great. We'll have to have you back on the show to talk about that one when it comes out next year.
You're very kind. I would love to.